Hey there, I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. This week's episode, we're going to be talking about episode 13 of our series on the conviction of Dennis Perry, Look at This Photograph, which exposed a cop who had grave misgivings about how the case was handled, and that the state's star witness was much more complicated than she seemed. With us today are Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. Hey there, Colin.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm good. And also with us is Susan Simpson. She's an associate at the Volkov Law Group, and she hosts the 45th podcast. Susan, how you doing?
Hey, John.
Also with us today, you are actually going to hear from young Ed Kostikian, which is very exciting because he's a name that's been bandied about, and we finally actually got to hear him a little bit on episodes recently, and I, for one, was thrilled to finally have a voice to the face. Well, actually, I don't even have the face. Someday I will have a voice and a face, hopefully. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
Ed is a law student at Columbia in the 2L, because you're in your second year.
It's a real thing, John, I promise.
It's a real thing. I swear. Okay, they told me 2L. I was like, that's not true. That's like Jor-El. It's like a name on Krypton. But you're at Columbia. And last summer, you interned at the Georgia Innocence Project, and that's where you became familiar with Dennis Perry's case. Is that true?
Yes, that's right.
So it was basically assigned to you. They dropped it on your desk and said, here, kid, check it out.
He volunteered for this, like, massive case. Yeah.
I had been a fan of Undisclosed for a long time prior to coming to law school. So going to Georgia Innocence Project, Claire Gilbert knew that I was familiar with the podcast, so was, you know, nice enough to give me the opportunity to work on the case.
So you've been a fanboy. Are you? How long did it take before you just stopped freaking out around Susan?
Susan's so nice and funny and weird and awesome that it didn't take that long.
Oh, okay, good.
Probably around the time it's like hour 12 of the day, and I'm like, Ed, we're gonna go somewhere else now. And it's like 11 o'clock. He's like, can we have dinner? Like, no, one more witness, then we get dinner. And then like everything's closed. So I'm like, oh shoot, I promised Ed dinner. How are we gonna get dinner now? About that time, you probably stopped being intimidated and more like, oh my God.
Yes. Well, it was also, that was when the low blood sugar was kicking in, I would imagine. So things would get ugly very quickly. Obviously, Ed, you're no longer shocked by how tall Susan is. Wait till you meet Colin. Let me tell you. you'll enjoy that. And Rabia is a normal sized person, you know, which now have you actually met them in person?
No, I haven't. Just Susan.
Not yet.
Oh, OK. Well, soon, Ed, soon. And it will be worth the wait. So to start off this episode, actually, I had a question from my assistant, Andrew, who asks, two-part question. Part one, is the title of this episode a reference to the Nickelback song Photograph? And part two, how dare you? So
it's a reference to nothing but Bundy.
Okay.
I plead innocence. No, it totally is.
Got it. Yeah, and it never fails to stun me that so much of this case is predicated on people matching a composite to a picture of Dennis.
As if a composite is a photograph, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it's just a basic logic fallacy. There's, you know, and especially it was one photo of Dennis. I mean, there's photos of me where, for all the world, I resemble John Hamm. but those are very rare photos. and I ain't going down for any murders that John Hamm commits. That's all I'm going to say. But yeah, I actually had a question about, I recall a couple of the church witnesses, either it was Vanzola or Cora, who said something to the effect of, they only said that the picture of Dennis that they saw resembled the composite, not that that necessarily resembled the actual killer that they saw.
That's the way Cora talks. Cora is also hard to understand. Like, she could say things that are hard to decipher and open to interpretation, but she's always talking about the composite and how much it looks like the photo. And you have to wonder how much of her identification of Dennis is an identification of the guy she saw in the church versus an identification of the guy in the composite versus the photo she was shown.
How did Bundy come upon that particular choice as that's the composite that he's showing? Because was that the same one that was shown on Unsolved Mysteries?
But yeah, they are all the composites are shown in Unsolved Mysteries. Although on Unsolved Mysteries, the composite's shown up side by side with a photo of Johnny Barentine.
Aha. Wait, they showed all four opposite a photo?
No, just the color one. The color one is side by side with Johnny Barentine. And then they flash the other four on the screen because they discuss another suspect that might resemble one of the other four. But yeah, so I mean, the color composite could look like a lot of people. It could look like Dennis, but it could look like Barentine. It's just very generic-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, as that woman mentioned so colorfully, that it could resemble pretty much any redneck in Georgia.
She meant it fondly.
Yes. No, absolutely. She wasn't being technical, I'm sure. I'm just curious if Bundy ever explained, was his process to show every composite or just there was just one that he picked?
We believe just the color composite. I know Ed spent some time on this trying to track down what photo is being talked about where, and it's hard. It's a mess.
It is hard, but I believe Bundy was just showing the color composite around, because something that I thought didn't come through on the episode was that the original four composites aren't sketches. They're identikit composites. So they're just made up of, like, distinct building blocks. They're not drawn out, if that makes sense.
They're not the artist they got from Florida for the final one.
Right.
When they put all the four women together in a room to do it together at once, which is not a standard way of doing a composite.
Mm-hmm. That is a very fascinating thing. I mean, I can understand why they would try to get clarity and just winnow it down to one, because when you got four wildly different composites, which there was three very similar ones and then one outlier. Is that's the Rick Astley?
Kind of, yeah, Cora Fisher's.
Yeah. I can understand the police trying to consolidate that just for clarity. But again, we see the pitfalls of that because, first of all, we're not sure that there was one assailant. And second of all, you're getting the memories of four different people mashed together into a human. And that has to be interpreted by an artist, another human who's got to impose their own thing on it.
So I'm the minority on this. Not alone, but minority. When I saw the photo for the composite for the first time, I remember my reaction was confusion because I did not necessarily read that composite as being of a white person. To me, it looked possibly that it was either Native American or possibly Hispanic. It was not necessarily to me. I didn't see that and think white redneck necessarily. And judging from the Unsolved Mysteries tips, there were a few who saw it the same way. So like you can project a lot of different things in that image. If you want to see Dennis Perry, you can see Dennis Perry. But you can see a lot of people if you want to see him there.
And again, a composite image is meaningless in terms of actual identification. It's interesting that we treat it with this, you know, that it is the product of expert workmanship, and not to impugn the artist in any way. But it's an impression from a description. That's all it is. I have to get to Jane Beaver because I had so many questions. First of all, Susan, just how did you get the actual binder full of the Unsolved Mysteries tips?
That's still there. It's one of the things that's remained with the file. It's long. There are a lot of tips in there. And I read every single one. And Jane Beaver's not in there.
Huh. Could there be any excuse for that one to have been pulled out, perhaps have been produced as evidence?
Yeah, because they were, I mean, Ed's seen the files. They're so disorganized. And they did pull out individual tips. So like you're going through the DA's files and you can find like a tip someone's pulled aside. And I can't say 100% for sure. I mean, I think it's possible that there could have been a Jane Beaver tip in there that was removed and got lost. But there's also just no indication that there ever was one.
Did the defense at Dennis's trial actually see those tips, or did they ever bring it up in the course of the trial?
Yes and no. Yes, they had the Unsolved Mysteries tips, and no, they did not bring this up. They didn't even read the tips they had that closely, because they do talk about some, and like it's just they're just wrong.
Huh. Yeah, you would think that, first of all, that would be strongly impeachable evidence if you could find that, you know, she hadn't, in fact, made the tip. Can I ask, did the DA make the point of mentioning that she had given the tip to Unsolved Mysteries in the opening statement, or
yeah.
Where was that?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's like the start of it. He's like, Unsolved Mysteries got a lot of calls, most were shit, but we got some good ones, and Jane Beaver called in. But the thing is, no one ever, or even Bundy, who was so critical of everyone else for not following the tip, he didn't follow the tip from Jane Beaver. He only found Jane Beaver from talking to Cora and Vanzola, he says. So if he missed the tip, then, I mean, if everyone else missed the tip, then so did he.
And is there any record of the tips that she supposedly called into the sheriff's office?
No.
No. Huh.
Nothing.
Is that something they generally keep track of?
I mean, in theory, in a normal case, yes. In this case, I mean, there's so much that's been lost that you have to, it's hard to be confident about what ever did exist and what didn't.
There are a million things you can do with Squarespace, and I should know because I've done a whole lot of them, from launching a business website to fundraising. Well, you can do so many things. You can turn your cool idea into a website. You can showcase your work that already exists, blog and publish content. You know me, Susan Collin, are all big bloggers. You can sell products and services of all kinds. Squarespace makes it easy because they have beautiful templates that are created by world-class designers. And they have powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online. Just imagine that. The ability to customize the look and feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks. And everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. And one of the most important aspects of having your website is having analytics. And Squarespace has analytics that help you grow in real time. They have built-in search engine optimization, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, which is fantastic because I can't actually do that stuff. So head to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Once again, all you gotta do is go to squarespace.com/undisclosed, design your own website. And when you are ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off the purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/undisclosed.
Have you been able to actually talk with Dennis's defense attorneys?
I mean, I'm here with them now.
His original ones.
Well, Ed, you talked to one of them.
I was able to talk to Ed Clary briefly, but we weren't able to have any like extended conversations or really obtain a lot of information.
Yeah, so far we're still not, I have not been able to, no.
Mm-hmm. Because I have huge questions for him. I'm going to have to call him. I'm going to have to.
I'll be on the line listening in.
Yes, exactly. Because there's so many things that they could clear up, you know, whether in fact they didn't pursue that as an avenue to impeach Jane Beaver, because that if that's something that's mentioned in the opening statement, you know, that's kind of a big deal. They're clearly using that evidence to buttress that she's, a reliable witness. So it would seem like, okay, that would beg a checkup to me.
I think you're right about that. No disagreement here.
Another big question I had is, obviously, when her mental health records were reviewed by the judge in camera, that was at a hearing, correct?
Yes, there's so much we don't know there, and we can't know there. We're just dealing with scraps and doing our best to go off of that. What we think we know is that there's supposed to be a hearing on February 10th in the morning that the trial starts. So they've already started jury selection, but the 10th, when the evidence is supposed to start, that morning there should have been a hearing of some sort. Some stuff came in under seal. Everything else is just guessing because that's all we know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but you found those notes that would seem to say that there was more there. And this was just never covered this is a gap in the transcript?
Well, the thing is, we don't have the full transcripts. We'll get more into that later exactly why, but essentially Dennis had no right to his transcripts and couldn't afford to pay for them, so they were never made. Eventually, partial transcripts were made, but we're still working off partial transcripts, and we do not have anything from that morning.
The reason I ask is because if there was a hearing about this, one would assume his defense attorney was present as well. And even though these, you know, obviously we have to respect that her mental health records were put in under seal. So, you know, there's a reason that the court has not allowed those to be public. But the defense attorney would know what they were in there if the hearing was, in fact, if it was held, wouldn't they?
Presumably. If they were actually handed, I mean, there's just so much we don't know. I mean, it's a black hole in several layers here because one, we don't have the transcripts. Two, we don't know from the attorneys. And three, the court's comments, whatever they were, that's not recorded. Like, this is all we have to go on. It's not an ideal situation by any means. But because that judge decided Dennis had no right to his transcripts, we don't even have the first layer there to rely on.
So, Colin, can I ask you, what is the normal procedure when something private, something has to be brought in under seal? If the judge chooses not to reveal any of that to the Sorry, how does that work? Could you let me know?
Yeah, and so this is something where the judge is balancing essentially two things. So under the Sixth Amendment, a defendant has a right to confront the witnesses against them. And so that would lend itself toward a finding that they can use these mental health records to impeach or call into question the credibility of these witnesses. On the other hand, we have the privacy rights of the witness who is just trying to testify and, you know, has an interest in the confidentiality of the records. And so what happens typically in these cases is when the defense makes a request to view these documents, the judge in camera, sort of in their chambers, is going to review these files. And it's quite possible that the judge made the ruling without defense counsel ever knowing the substance of these files. And so it's possible there was a hearing where both sides were there and the defense actually knew what was in the files and heard the judge's ruling. But it's also quite possible the judge made this decision and made the decision that the privacy rights of Jane Beaver were so important that the defense would never have any idea what those records said.
Mm-hmm. But in that case, though, the DA wouldn't have any idea what those records said either and wouldn't be able to make little notes in the margins about what was in there either, I would imagine, because that would be unfair.
I mean,
yeah, that's true,
yeah. We know something. All we can say, well, I think we can say for certain, is that there is some additional information that we don't have access to, like specific, because there is, when those notes go on to say things like tobacco use, like I think three and a half years ago or something like that, you know, something a medical record would have, but it's very specific. So at some point, someone saw specific details about her medical records and wrote them down, and we don't have them now.
Yeah, and John, it might be the case where the state had these records and made notes, and then the judge has this hearing and then reviews those records. So it could be something where the prosecution had made notations before the judge reviewed it, and still the defense never had that opportunity.
Would that constitute a Brady violation?
And, well, it depends on what's in the records. Without knowing that, we can't say.
I mean, because if there was serious questions about her mental illness, and obviously if you suffer from a mental illness, that doesn't necessarily mean you're unreliable as a witness in any way. But the specific things that were noted down there, that would constitute something that would impugn a witness.
We don't know anything about like when or where or what. We just don't know. I mean, yes, I had very serious questions and I would love to get answers. But right now it's hard to be. We can't be conclusive because we just don't know what's going on. But there are suggestions, both from the notes and from other witnesses, that there's a story here that's very significant and important to, you know, Dennis's case that we just don't know about.
And oh my gosh, at one point you sort of dropped a bomb that it sounded as though, and please tell me if I got this wrong, that Jane Beaver has suffered losing two children, one to suicide and one to murder, and then also lost her spouse to suicide. Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
She's had a hard life. She did pass away recently. And yeah, she definitely had a hard life.
Well, yeah, that would certainly explain some, you know, the thing that she got treatment for. The adjustment issue could be any one of those horrible scenarios. Oh, my gosh. And Carol Ann, her daughter, obviously had to go through losing two siblings. And I don't know if the spouse was her father.
I don't believe so, but.
Mm-hmm. But still, Carol Ann seems like an enigma. Did you actually get to spend much time with her?
Not that much. Mm-hmm. Ed was there too. We talked. She was not, I would not say she is enthusiastic about talking about this case at all. That's probably fair to say. She did talk about half an hour, but I get it actually. It's not fair. I do understand it. Before I talked to her, I was really trying to understand how that the records I had did not suggest she bought onto this theory. She was not supporting her mother's case. She wasn't adding to Dennis's guilt, except for that story that she says she never said in the first place about Dennis coming down to Camden County on the 11th or the 10th. But she's also never like come out strongly in his favor. After talking to her, yeah, I think she does believe Dennis is innocent because she just doesn't see how he could have done it. But she just has kind of not thought too hard about what her mother did, I think. That's my impression only, not what she said. But that's how I sort of understand that contradiction.
Well, and she sort of explained it. It sounded to me like she felt that he did say the thing about the glasses and that he may well have said the other things, but that her mother misunderstood them.
Well, she didn't even say that. She just kind of like says like, well, she did misunderstand things. She wouldn't say specifically for this it was misunderstanding, but she would say that like she'd misunderstand things and they didn't always agree. I still like really don't know why she just was convinced that like I was there to talk about the glasses. That was like the first thing that came to her mind. is the mother's glasses, his mother's glasses that he apparently did talk about at some point or wore as a joke. I don't even know.
It would be an odd thing to jump. It's so interesting because when, you know, people who've actually gone through the experience often fixate on things that don't seem a part of the bigger picture. And in her case, it sounds like, you know, if her mother was suffering from mental illnesses, that would make her, I would totally understand her having horribly mixed feelings about this whole thing.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it. She told me that she thought there's something funny about this whole thing. I didn't say it, but I was thinking, I'm like, yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, so many issues. Like, how did Jane still have the photo of Dennis to show around? I mean, their relationship was over at that point, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I guess my mom has stuff that, like, I have no idea what she has in boxes in her attic. So maybe, like, I could see Jane Bieber having that. But there is a weird story that comes up later about how another photo of Dennis Perrier that Jane Bieber had got lost because Jane Bieber, like, left it out on her windowsill or something and it got rained on. Like, why are you leaving out pictures of murder in your living room?
Yeah. Again, if she actually had the interaction that, you know, was clearly upsetting to her, she even said at the time that she, when he said that, supposedly, she had an angry reaction to it. You know, why would you? First of all, I wouldn't want that guy dating my daughter.
She did not want him. Yeah, that's true. I still don't have the impression that she ever hated him that much that could be explain her motive. Maybe it could. I just don't get that impression. But she is pretty adamant that she did not want him dating Carol Ann.
Yeah, as I said, Carol Ann's really an enigma here. You know, to a listener, you're like, well, why didn't she defend him when, you know, when this happened? If she knows that he wouldn't hurt a fly, which seems to be what she alludes to, you know, why didn't she stand up for this, you know? And it seems very odd to say, well, I didn't hear him say that to her, and that's what my mom says. I don't know. It rubs a lot of people the wrong way, I think.
I don't know. I have sympathy for her. I don't think, I will say this. She definitely did not in any way want to help Dennis's conviction. She did not, she was a state's witness. She was called for the state, but she just said what she knew. I do believe that. At trial, she said exactly what she knew and no more. She did nothing to try and help the conviction, like deliberately. She was just there to say whatever she, answer whatever questions she got, not really understanding why she was being asked certain questions. Yeah. There's no, I mean, Ed, do you agree with that or am I projecting here?
Yeah, I agree with that. I can't really say anything about her motives at the time, but at least at this point, she was clear that she didn't think Dennis was guilty, and she just seemed scared.
Confused.
Yeah.
And I would imagine a lot of people at the time thought the police had more evidence than that. You know, a lot of the time you don't think that your evidence is the one key piece of evidence. You know, you figure, oh, the cops have a whole big case. You know, they're bringing them into court and all these, you know, important adults are speaking. And, you know, they must have more than this.
She said that. She's like, I was trying to like ask her, like, why will if I mean, you know, your mother was a big part of this, right? Not that way, but, you know, trying to get her to see what her reaction would be. And she was like, well, I read in the news they had more evidence. I'm like, okay. So she did definitely seem to believe that it was not her mother. I don't think Carol Ann understands how critical her mother's role was in this case. I'll put it that way.
And I think you've come in contact with that in a lot of these cases of wrongful convictions, of people not understanding that their tiny piece of the puzzle ended up being incredibly important. And they always assumed there was a universe of other evidence that made the person guilty.
That's for sure. And, you know, it just... The defense did talk to Carol Ann before trial. She's one of the ones I did go out and read and speak to. I don't think they got as in. She was happy to talk to them. That she answered their questions. I don't think they necessarily got into enough detail with her. But she never indicated she was hostile to the defense in any way. So she should have been an asset to the defense. And it did not come off that way at trial.
Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Here's how it works. You choose chef-designed recipes, they deliver fresh, seasonally inspired ingredients, you then cook the incredible meals in as little as 20 minutes. Blue Apron has quick and easy recipe options with insanely delicious flavors and perfectly portioned ingredients delivered right to your door, so you can skip meal planning and get straight to cooking with Blue Apron. Now next week, once again, we're doing something I love, a Blue Apron dinner party with friends, and the meals sound delicious. A seared salmon grain bowl with roasted vegetables and lemon yogurt sauce, and smoky Brussels sprout and black bean tacos with roasted sweet potatoes. Before Blue Apron, I was a serviceable cook who hated to take the time to figure out what to buy and make for dinner. But now, Blue Apron has made dinner so much easier for me, and they can do the same for you. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/undisclosed. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed to get your first three meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I had a question about how you do these interviews, Susan, because seriously, the Ellerson interview was very helpful. And obviously, you got stuff out of Carol Ann. And Ed, you can probably chime in on this as well. how do you get these people to open up to you?
I just ask and hope they answer. It's kind of what it comes down to. Like, it's just, I don't have any strategy. I don't really have a, like, I don't know. It's not something I was trained to, just ask is really what it comes down to. Bundy said that in his interview with me, and it's actually true. Like, if you just show up and ask, oftentimes you'll get an answer.
Ed, has that been really a fascinating part of the process for you?
I mean, I definitely felt like there was more skill and tactic to it. And watching Susan, she was really good at knowing what the right questions were to ask. I mean, maybe it was just instinct, but I felt like she was really good at, you know, knowing what questions to ask that would get people to open up even when they weren't interested in doing so to begin with. Because there were many times where people were initially not quite hostile, but definitely did not want to talk to us. But
then, borderline hostile.
but then ended up, you know, standing with us outside of their house for half an hour, talking to us about the case. So I thought Susan was really good at that.
Often the key is just like the stress. Like, I mean, it depends on the person. People, like, some people are fine talking to certain people and not others. But for me, it's like getting across quick. I'm not a cop. I'm not here to take you to a grand jury. I'm not here to put you on a witness stand. Like, I am just here to learn. And once they're convinced that I'm not there for, like, something that's going to cause chaos or cause them to be subpoenaed or something, they get more chatty. So once you can, sometimes with some witnesses who are a little bit standoffish, once you can, like, cross that border and, like, make them feel sure that you're not there to haul them into court, they'll talk.
And Ed, being a part of this process and having been a fan in the past, what have you learned?
What have I learned about Undisclosed? About
yes, all the dirty secrets.
I mean, I don't know. I guess it was a lot like I expected it to be, but it was incredibly cool being part of it. I mean, I have listened to every episode of Undisclosed since it started, and, you know, was always a huge fan of Susan and Rabia and Colin. So, like, getting to be on the ground working with the podcast and, like, even on this and hearing my own voice on it, it's really a dream come true in a lot of ways.
He got to see all the boring and chaotic bits. There's a lot of chaos.
It was amazing. It was the best summer.
Well, I would expect the boring bits. The chaos is fairly new, I would imagine.
Oh, there's so much chaos. It's just all the moving parts, trying to, like, the logistics, just trying to get everything, just trying to get everyone in one place together is hard, which is probably not my skill set, why it's harder, but just trying to, like, get everything organized. That's the hard part.
Yeah, I always imagined that it was all just pouring through old, dusty documents and boxes. And
that is that, but I love that part. So
you love that part. Interesting.
That's the high point.
Really? So, Ed, how do you feel about that part?
I mean, I like that part. It's always interesting when you find new things or that have been overlooked. Susan's like the queen of that. But I really enjoyed getting to drive around Georgia and just interview all these people who had each, you know, their own little portion of the story to tell. I think that was my favorite part.
Yeah, and there's so much that just, like, it's, there's so much that, and I know we cover a lot of the podcast. I know there's a lot of details. But honestly, it's a fraction of what, like, happens and what we learn. And there's so much that's not even related to the case that I want to learn more about and want to just tell more about. And it's, you know, it can be really far afield. And I find this witness and I start talking, like, okay, forget the Perry case for a second. Let's hear all about this thing. And so Ed was there for that. So he gets to hear all the cool stuff that, like, I wish we could cover on the show and then we can't. And just, but to hear the stories, like, drive around to, like, say, like, okay, we don't know how this is going to go. This person's not going to talk. This person's not going to be there. And then they are there and they chat and you learn from them and you, like, walk away. And they always say at the end, like, well, I'm sorry I couldn't be any help to you. They all say that, and you walk away, you're like, wow, I really get this piece now. I understand how my sort of an internal conception of how this fit together was a little bit off, and now I get it.
And every now and then you run across Gary Mitchum Reeves, who ends up on their own podcast.
And every now and then one of my little side journeys ends up being its own podcast.
Now, I had a question about some of the Ellerson revelations. Do you feel like if he had revealed to defense attorneys that he didn't recall the photo being actually shown to Venzola Williams, do you think that the defense attorneys could have made something of that at the time?
Oh, I think it would have been huge, because that would have been a recent-ish memory. This many years on, it's, you know, it's been, like you said, he can't say for certain, but I think his memory would have been much fresher back then. It made a lot more powerful impact. And then someone would have recognized what was staring them all in the face, which is Venzola, who's just telling you, I don't actually recall seeing a photo, and everyone brushing it off. And I gotta say, I'm really, really glad that Ed failed to catch Ellerson at home, because he went first and Ellerson wasn't there that day. And I went later and caught him. I was really, he was awesome to talk to. So I was glad it worked out like that. Sorry, Ed.
I figured out where he lived and worked.
You did. You did. He did the hard work of driving around and finding where this guy was. And then I had the fun part of swooping in and talking to him.
So when you guys are actually meeting people, do you stay in town, like at a motel in town, or do you always hang out in Atlanta?
No, it's about three, four hours down here. So we stay here. Right now, in fact, I'm staying at the house of the first mayor of Woodbine.
Oh.
Yeah, it's cute. I love this house. It's like a little southern, you know, I don't even know what kind of style you call it. But yeah, I was saying before, it's pretty nice. I like staying close to where you're doing it, just because you can learn more. You can go out and eat at a restaurant and like happen to find someone and learn more from them. So yeah, we try and stay close. And when I'm on my own by myself, I basically just, you know, work until it's too late to talk to people and then find the nearest like motel and just crash there for the night and then repeat.
So at some point, we have got to get in touch with this, was it Ed Cleary, the defense attorney? Do you feel like they might be a little defensive because it didn't go well?
Yeah, I think that's always a factor. I think that's part of it. Mm-hmm. I know that, and also they're not, in general, attorneys are less likely to talk to a reporter. So I know GIP is working on that.
Because, you know, there's so many questions. I mean, again, do you think that if they had been able to show that there was no record in the Unsolved Mysteries and there was no record of her with the Sheriff's Department, do you feel like that could have been used?
But see, I think they had that. I mean, it's frustrating with the transcripts because, like, to me, when you first read the transcripts, it does not necessarily stand out that there's some gaps there. But once you know the case better, like, I don't know, Ed, did you have experience like reading their case especially? But they like just get to a point where there's a question that you know so badly reading it you want them to ask next, and they just move right on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll say, I mean, there is a rule of evidence, an exception to the rule against hearsay, that says if there's an absence of a record, that can be used to show the non-occurrence of that event. And so certainly from an evidentiary standpoint, they could have used the absence of reference to her to show that these reports that they were alleging were never in fact made.
Obviously, you're dealing with a huge absence of reports in that all of the evidence is now gone. But you're saying that contemporaneously, if as the trial goes across, if there's no evidence of it, they can use that as evidence of absence?
Yeah, exactly. There should have been a tip there, and it's not there. So why? Why didn't they like push that harder? Maybe it got lost, sure, but make them explain that. That's like we have a lot of Unsolved Mysteries tips. So like of all the stuff that went missing, it doesn't seem like Unsolved Mysteries tips was it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and actually you sent me a list of the Unsolved Mysteries tips. And yes, just as caller believes that blacks were involved to get money. There we go. There's a good one. Caller wonders if the KKK was checked out. Well, you know, we wondered that as well. Caller saw someone last week with long blonde hair, 110 to 165 pounds.
Thanks, dude.
That's it.
Really helpful.
I saw somebody. Caller suggests looking for fingerprints on glasses. You know, it's wonderful that people are like, you know, chiming in with, you know, hey, here's an idea, law enforcement. Why don't you have you tried this yet? Here we go. Caller says suspect looks like the lead guy in the group Boy Meets Girl.
He does, though. Remember that? We're like, who the hell is Boy Meets Girl? And we looked it up, and I was like, okay, you know what? They solid point. You know, this tip was this was a hot tip. I still want to question him.
Yes. Now, what did they sing? Do you have any? What's their discography?
We played a song by it, and I've already forgotten it.
Wow. Okay. Sorry, Boy Meets Girl. If you guys were fans of Undisclosed, no longer. Okay. Caller says, I'm married to the suspect, bald, and looks like a poodle. That was my wife, actually. I'm sorry.
But how are you bald? Like, how is someone both bald
and looks like a poodle? A bald poodle. Maybe they're just bald in certain areas and, like, rings around their... That's... oh, gosh. Wait, a little boy called, asked if there were killers in Buffalo, New York. He apologized for his sister hanging up. So there's a whole domestic turmoil going on in that house. And let's see. This is the last one. A caller is Percy Betts and says he has a message for Robert Stack. Caller says that he remembers when he used to shoot skeet with him. And this was in the 50s.
There's like tons of these. I was just fascinated by all the ones calling him. And like trying to find the useful ones is kind of hard because there's so much of this stuff. So I know what Bundy and Gregory are talking about when they're like, yeah, we got lots of tips. But yeah, I mean.
It was the internet of its day, basically. It was the
like the pre-internet days. Like you couldn't like go online and talk about it, so you call the tip line.
Oh, gosh.
Ever walk by someone in the street and think they smell like $1 million? With many brands, that can be true in more ways than one. But Scentbird.com can keep you smelling good month after month at a price that won't break the bank. When I found out we're being sponsored by Scentbird, I signed up for their Pick a Scent Each Month service and quickly forgot about it. A few days later, commented to my wife about how good she smelled, and she said she was wearing the Burberry Brit Chic perfume we had gotten from Scentbird. A month later, my wife had a new wonderful fragrance. This time it was Pink Sugar by Aqualina, also from Scentbird. That's the beauty of Scentbird.com. You don't need to buy one of those big perfume bottles that you'll get bored of after a month and that will sit in your shelf for years. With Scentbird, you choose a new scent every month from 450 brands like Prada, Gucci, Kate Spade, Nest, and more. And they'll send you a 30-day trial. It's kind of like a choose-your-own-scent adventure. And with Scentbird, it's always free shipping all the time, so you can skip the department store and pushy salespeople. That's why I use Scentbird.com. And now, with this exclusive offer, you'll get 50% off your first month today. That's only $7.50 for your first perfume. That's Scentbird.com/undisclosed and use my code undisclosed for 50% off your first month. Scentbird.com/undisclosed. Sign on, smell amazing.
I had a couple of last questions about Dale Bundy's note-taking procedures. You know, so often we railed about it on a few episodes ago about the fact that ends up giving, a huge amount of the benefit of the doubt to the investigators because of his sort of, shall we say, freeform style of keeping records on these things. Is that still in any way acceptable in law enforcement nowadays?
I don't think it was then.
Uh-huh. It was unusual even then.
Ed, were you there when we were talked with Chuck Byerly?
First time, yeah.
Yeah, and he was like, I think we asked him about that, and he was like, that's just how Bundy does it, implying it was not a Camden County Sheriff's Office approach, it was a Bundy approach. Mm. He also told us that Bundy had come and gone from Sheriff's Office 5 times.
Yes, he seems like an odd choice. By the way, he had some very interesting thoughts, and he obviously was willing to do the legwork, which was great. And as you said, he did actually seem to have a very good memory for things, by and large. But he does seem an odd guy to reach out to bring back in to an investigation. At some point, I hope you guys on the show will get into why, if there's any clue as to why he was chosen.
I don't know if we can answer the why, but there is more in the how.
Okay. I'm looking forward to that. Myself, because I was just at a barbecue with a woman who I discovered was a district attorney in Los Angeles. And I mentioned that small detail that was a part of the case we were looking into. She's a big fan, by the way. And her eyes just bugged out. She just thought that is just the craziest thing.
To bring in an investigator for this?
No, not to bring in an investigator. His record keeping. To not do reports contemporaneously and in any kind of depth, but to just sort of generalize it months after the fact. Just seems crazy.
It does. And you know what? It's very possible that is really how Bundy did things. And he says he did it that way. And it really could be. But I think it is fair to wonder if that's necessarily the case. Did he actually not take any notes and just write summaries later? Or were there notes that he summarized and then misplaced?
That didn't even occur to me. I love that you think that way. And Ed, I hope this kind of cynicism is rubbing off on you because
he did also tell us that it was Joe Gregory's job basically to do the records and to make the tape recordings, and he didn't have to.
Yeah, oh, not Joe Gregory, but Ron Rhodes. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Ron Rhodes.
But so the thing is, though, the GBI didn't come in until like November, and he started in June. So he did tell us, yeah, that, you know, that's the GBI. I let them do the note taking. But like, okay, the GBI wasn't working on this case for the first like 4 or 5 months you were on it. So does that just mean no one takes the notes?
Well, you know that obviously Ellerson went on. Who took the notes in that dynamic?
That's right. Ellerson was there and does not recall. And that's another, I wish that the attorneys had talked to him back then, because he was reluctant to be that confident that, for instance, Vanzolo was not shown a photo this many years onwards. But when I tried to talk to him about it, he just had no recollection of that. It was just like it was clear there was not any indication in his brain that it happened, and he was struggling and failing to summon some memory of that happening. Mm-hmm. So things like that, if they had documented what happened in that interview, if there had been like more detailed records of it, then it'd be, I think, easier for Ellerson to go like, okay, I don't recall that, but here's exactly how it went. This seems like, you know, a very detailed record of what happened. That's how it happened. And he says that now, but it's harder to trust in that sort of record keeping when it's just a brief summary written months later.
One thing I think that buttresses the fact that she probably wasn't shown the photograph was that if she was and she recognized it, that would have been significant. That would have been considered a very significant moment in the investigation and something an investigator would probably remember.
You think, given that he was already having questions about why they're looking at Dennis Perry, you think maybe that would resolve some of them or leave some kind of imprint. Because he didn't remember everything. He definitely had memory gaps. He was struggling to recall some stuff, but he had a lot of memories of the case. He did remember a lot about it. And it does seem like that would be something that might be more likely to have left an imprint, but, you know, you can't say for sure if that's the case.
And did he mention the actual circumstances of him being taken off? Because he was kind of general about it. He said, I let them know that I didn't think he was guilty, and then they let me go. I'm curious, you know, did it actually come down to a conversation of him saying, you know what, I can't find anything on this guy, and them saying, well, thank you for trying, you know, and best of luck to you.
He was still at the sheriff's office. He just was not on the case. That's like basically I'm projecting here, but I kind of get the sense of him, like, you know, the younger investigator. He'd been at the sheriff's office for a while, but he'd just been recently kind of become in the investigative role. So he's a new investigator, new detective, and he like goes to the files. He's like, huh, I've got a new theory. I'm going to go tell the older deputies like my brilliant insight into this case. Mm-hmm. Not like that. I'm really exaggerating here. But like, I get that impression of him, you know, reaching a conclusion and be like, huh, here's what I think and why. Let's go talk to the big guys about this. And then they're like, cool, thanks, bye. And they stop talking to him about the case. He just was, they're like, okay, fine, you're not working on it anymore. The end.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like when he got there that it was already pretty much tunnel vision at that point.
When he got on the case, it was Perry and only Perry.
So here's the deal. I do not know the first thing about investing. So I was a little bit nervous when I first heard about the Robinhood app. Well, I didn't have to be, because Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, options, and cryptos all commission-free and in a completely non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers like me to invest for the first time with true confidence. The app is simple and intuitive. Clear design with data presented in an easy to digest way. And I love getting notifications about how my stocks are doing. The other things that are amazing about the Robinhood app is that there's no commission fees. Now, other brokerages charge up to $10 for every single trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees. Trade stocks and keep all of your profits. That's pretty amazing. The app has easy to understand charts and market data. You can place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone, and their platform lets you view stock collections like the 100 most popular, you know, or sectors like entertainment and social media, and curated categories like female CEOs. Also, they have analyst ratings of buy, hold, sell for every single stock. You can learn by doing. Learn how to invest as you build your portfolio, which has been really valuable to me. Now, Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. All you have to do to get your free stock is sign up at undisclosed.robinhood.com. Once again, don't miss out on this amazing offer. Get a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint by signing up at undisclosed.robinhood.com.
Well, I wanted to get to some social media questions, and actually they're all sort of around the same theme. We got one from Stacey Orrick, who says, I'm curious as to why you're covering this case. Dennis can't appeal, right? I'm hearing IAC all over the place, and I'm hearing botched police detective work as well. And then Alexander Henderson chimed in on this as well and said, I wondered that too. I suppose the law could be changed, but I would have expected a full court press on that in every single episode if that were the goal. Elections are fast approaching. So that is a question.
About why we're doing this? And I don't I guess it's a very valid question. But at the same time, I'm like, well, doesn't his story deserve to be told too?
Yeah.
I mean.
And just because we don't yet have an avenue to fix it, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try.
Yeah. It's, I mean, the law is a complicated thing. Just in, as a general rule, if someone tells you it's impossible under the law and there's something really egregious under the facts, it's worth rechecking. But on the other hand, like, I mean, you never know what you'll find when you start looking. I mean, Ed, did that ever like come when you were assigned to this case? Were you ever like, why are we working on this thing?
I mean, honestly, no. I mean, from maybe like, you know, Georgia Innocence Project has very limited resources. So maybe there's more of a question why that's, you know, they're taking on the case. But from the point of view of like Undisclosed, I think it's an even bigger reason to share his story because he has no other avenue of, you know, that no one will ever know otherwise. And also with this kind of appellate waiver, you know, if there are reasons, like if someone wants to hide something with an appellate waiver like this, and I'm not saying that's what happened in this case.
But if it did.
Right. Then they shouldn't be able just to not have these stories told, right? I think it makes it even more important to tell the story.
And that's a good point. I mean, actually, one of the reasons we did do this case is because it's, I mean, it was, so when we choose cases, part of the issue is like, are we going to hurt someone's legal chances? Are we going to impede a legal route? And we do kind of look for cases that are like out of their options. And for this one, it made it pretty simple to say, yep, this one's out of options. So, I mean, not to be, this is the wrong way of putting it, but like, we can't really hurt him, can we?
Yes,
I mean, but like, honestly, this is the case. If we, it's easier to say that, like, yeah, might as well try everything. And I would argue that even if I was confident we couldn't do anything about it, this is a case that's still worth telling, a story we're still worth telling, because this is not just about Dennis, it's about what's going on in Camden County. On the other hand, I'm not going to say that's why we're doing it, because there's always complications in the law and always complications in the facts. And yeah, I would like to see what this end with Dennis getting his day in court, essentially. And I think that it's possible. Like, I mean, I definitely do not believe, based on what we know now, that's not something that could ever happen. It could happen, and I hope it does.
Well, Alexander Henderson actually continued his question and said, I also wondered about the implication near the end that a DA could dismiss a conviction arbitrarily. I know a judge can on appeal, though one usually hears about ordering a new trial, but I've never heard that a DA could do so absent a court ruling. What would stop, say, a new corrupt DA from dismissing charges against a mafia member after taking a bribe? And bringing charges later would be difficult at best, as a DA is not a finder of fact. I can't find any case law one way or the other, at least not with a casual search. Is this a state-by-state thing? Which I think we've got to throw this to Colin.
Surprise! Nothing stopping them.
Oh, really?
Well, what? Okay, look, think of the story. Think of Donnie Barentine and Jeff Kittrell and David Robertson. Why wouldn't the DA charge them?
You're right. I can't think of a good reason.
But, like, honestly, it's a question. His reasoning was that he didn't want, quote, prostitutes and drug users in his courthouse. But also a lot of, you know, that's kind of how this works. As a DA, you're going to have prostitutes and drug users in your courthouse. So I think that's one thing we've looked at. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but yeah, it's something you have to consider, and it's possible that can happen. There's times it has happened, and it's one thing I have questions about.
Yeah, Colin, so it sounded like there were some esoteric legal questions there. It, like, can a DA actually dismiss this thing in Georgia?
I'm not sure about the specific rules in Georgia, but generally speaking, it would be the district attorney going before the judge and saying, we believe this is now a bad conviction, and assuming the judge doesn't have his own reasons for maintaining this conviction, you have the defense and the DA saying, we want these charges thrown out. Absolutely, that can happen, and the judge will pretty much rubber stamp it.
Got it. So it still is up to the judge, technically, but
they can't unilaterally do it, but.
Right.
Ah, okay. that does change things. Yes, and our last question was from Lisa Angela, who says basically, is anything from this episode enough to actually help Dennis Perry? There was a lot to call into question reasonable doubt, but does that matter now?
No, because we need more information. I mean, it helps in that we know what questions to ask now and what we should look for. But you can't make, I mean, what we need is to get the records. We need the transcripts. We need to find out what is in that case file. That's the next step.
And is the only barrier between the transcripts and us actually paying for them?
There's a lot of barriers. That part's been taken. It's getting to the court reporter, getting copies, getting that requested. Knock on wood, I think that as far as I know at this point, we can hopefully one day get all the transcripts. We'll see. But yeah, other stuff too, like in the court file, like you need a court to the sealed stuff in there. We need a court order to get, which a podcast is not going to get, but GIP might be able to one day.
So they would have to start a legal proceeding demanding it. Got it. And at the time, no transcript was made because Dennis just wasn't able to pay for it.
He didn't have the $10,000 or whatever. And yeah, he had no right to it because he had waived all his appeal rights.
Right. If you're indigent and you are appealing, then automatically you get a copy of the trial transcript. But because he had waived his appellate rights, that's, as Susan says, the reason why he wasn't able to get it.
Huh. I really do wonder what he was informed of when he agreed to sign away his appellate rights. I mean, it just feels like there's so many repercussions to that it would take a good afternoon of a lawyer just talking you through the repercussions of that before you really could sign that with any kind of real consent.
I like how you assume he signed something.
Oh, he didn't sign anything?
He was convicted. And within like, kind of goes, it's like within half an hour, 40 minutes, this has happened. There's no time to think. He wanted to talk to his family. They're like, you can't do that. So he's like got, like he is just this moment, he is convicted of two murders. He's got proof now. The justice system is not always going to do the right thing. And he's being told, okay, well, guess what? You might not be killed if you agree to this thing that we're going to do. And so there's no extent. Then yes, his attorneys talked to him about it. And that's an issue that came up later when he tried to have a post-conviction proceeding. Mm-hmm. But there is not much time to go over any of this. And certainly not things like transcripts. That's not what the attorney is focused on and not what's the priority right there to discuss.
That's what I mean, is that there's a lot of minutiae involved to waiving that right. And it would feel like, the Constitution would guarantee that somebody would be made aware of the stuff they're actually signing away at that time.
It's a lot of minutiae when the question before you is, do you want to die or not?
Exactly. So he has tried to have a post-conviction proceeding based on the grounds that he wasn't informed of these things, or no?
Yes, close to that. We'll get into more later, but there was back in, oh God, Ed, what year was it? I'm counting on you. 04?
Yeah, I think 2004.
04, I'm pretty sure. There was an attempt at a post-conviction thing, and we'll discuss that more on the show, but obviously it did not succeed. Spoiler.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you guys. Thank you guys so much. Thank you, Ed. It was such a pleasure to finally speak with you.
Well, thank you for having me.
You did not disappoint.
And thank you for working on this case. Ed, if you want to drop out of law school and come back to GIP, I'm sure Claire would make arrangements for you.
Yes. Really, I'm sure your parents would be thrilled.
GIP, but I want to finish law school first.
Just saying, offer stands.
And thank you, Colin. And thank you, Susan. Every week I think, okay, we're wrapping up. And then I go, oh, no, there's so much more to go into. And I'm very much looking forward. And that's it for the addendum. I want to remind everybody real quick that Undisclosed does have a Patreon. It is patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And you can sign up there. You can join the Patreon, donate a little bit, and you get special access to special episodes of just Colin, Robbie, and Susan yammering on to their heart's content. It's very exciting. And if you have any information regarding Dennis Perry's case, please call us at 410-205-5563 or email us at undisclosedpod@gmail.com. If you feel like checking out our website, it is undisclosed-podcast.com. There's a list of the criminal justice-related charities you can make a donation to. As I've said in the past, I'm donating all of my fees for this season to the Georgia Innocence Project, and they are not paying Ed Kosticki in any of it because he is an unpaid intern. But I hope they're giving him living expenses or something. You can find them on the web at georgiainnocenceproject.org. Or maybe they are paying him. I don't know. I don't know these things. I'm just making jokes. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at our handle @UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. My assistant, Andrew, came through not just with jokes, but also research this week, so I appreciate him greatly. Also want to thank Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Methil, you always get the last thanks, but it's just wrong, because you are everything to this show. Thank you, Methil. So I hope you all have a great week, and I'm looking forward to our next addendum.